Hey everybody, Michael Thiessen here for Liberty Coalition Canada, and today I am interviewing Dr. Crystal Lechkew. And Dr. Lechkew, thank you so much for being on and chatting with me at this time.
Thank you very much for having me and for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you and I live in the same area, I think. I live down in Alliston, and whereabouts in the greater Barrie area do you live?
I actually live in Innisfil, right kind of down the end of Big Bay Point Road.
Okay.
Yeah, so close.
And you and I are talking today because you are a palliative care clinician. And why don't you share a little bit about your roles in the medical community within the Barrie area?
So I'm a family doctor and a palliative care doctor. So at the hospital, I have been a hospitalist in my early independent practice years. And then I kind of transitioned into palliative care, and then I started doing locums, and then I started my own practice. Well, actually, I took over practice. But I continued doing palliative care because it's very rewarding and a very needed service in our community and at the hospital. So I'm born and raised in Barrie, and my family and my husband's family are here, and we're raising our family here too.
Well, it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. So before we started recording, I kind of told you what my hopes for this interview are, and yes. I'll just repeat them for our listeners, and you feel free to interact with my hopes or to dash them. But one of the things that we have been experiencing in our province for months and months and months is the fact that our provincial government and the Ontario Science Table, the COVID command table, can mm-hmm. shut down our province at will. They can mandate vaccinations against all informed consent. And many, many people that I speak to are greatly concerned and utterly stressed out. And on the other side of the fence, you have those who hear about that news and say, well, you guys are overreacting. Like, the hospitals are full. This is a terrible pandemic. And you know, whatever the doctors say has to happen, whether or not you feel like your rights are being violated. So I have been dying to know what is actually going on inside the medical community. And I know that you doctors face a tremendous amount of pressure not to talk openly about these things. But being 25 minutes away from where you practice, I have been sitting here for 18 months going, if I had a spy camera in that place. So, first question that I would have for you is, can you describe the situation at RVH so our listeners kind of understand what's been going on inside the hospital?
Sure. So it's a bit of a, you know, compartmentalized kind of process. I'm not in every area in the hospital. I do have patients that are palliative that are on various floors, but you know, the vast majority of the time they're on the cancer palliative ward at the hospital. So we can't really comment on the state of, say, the ICU, for instance, or certain floors or wards. But as a general experience that I have lived through and worked through over the last 18 months, I can share what I've seen and what I've been dealing with. So by and large, the hospital has been definitely not overrun by any means. It's been very manageable in terms of the number of patients. In fact, it's been less than probably we've ever had in the hospitals. Again, certain wards or certain places may be busier than others, and I cannot really comment on our ICU. I've spoken with some of the physicians there, and I do know that there have been times where it's been very busy and very scary. But the vast majority of the information that we get, you know, as a whole for the whole hospital, the numbers are always well below our capacity. And we have that extra pandemic response unit that was built, and it's never actually had probably more than 15 patients in it at a time. There was definitely lots of room and lots of access from my lived experience. I've had patients in the pandemic response unit, and it's always fully staffed. And I can't say that for the other wards, to be honest. There's staffing shortages in certain areas of the hospital, and I'm not sure why, but never in that area, which is probably pretty concerning to anybody, because there was never very many patients in there, so it didn't require full staff at all times. But again, there's probably some kind of provincial accommodation that has to be met in order to have that funding. But in my eyes, patient care and patient safety does not come down to funding. It doesn't come down to the government saying yes or no to money. It comes down to what is best for that patient and how can we make them comfortable or better or whatever our goals of care are. But the focus of patient care should always be on that patient and their individual safety and goals of care.
So we were talking just a little bit, and you mentioned that they, do we have the ability to compare other years? Like, again, as an outsider, you would think that, you know, we're in a year of a pandemic. There's been triple the deaths. There's been triple the capacity problems. But you had mentioned that maybe comparatively that there might be a different story there.
Well, again, just in my experience, I've worked in that hospital for 7 years now, and compared to any other year, the last 18 months has been very empty compared to 2018, 2019. Again, certain areas of the hospital may have been busier, but overall, by and large, the halls were empty, and the capacity at the hospital was nowhere close to full, or most times we're above that. We're at 110 or 115% capacity. And that wasn't seen. Patients that are going through the emergency department normally would have a very extended wait. I don't think that was always the experience over the last 18 months. I think we could look at things like funeral homes and crematories. None of them have been inundated with bodies that they can't handle. Do you know what I mean? Or you know, the amount of deaths that are occurring at one time have never been too much to handle. There's never been a big backlog. There's never been, we can't take that patient from the morgue yet, that kind of thing. Hospice is another area where, you know, sometimes there's beds and sometimes there's not. And often we were able to get patients in there from the hospital, which was excellent. So I think my experience was definitely very different, and it was quieter in terms of the number of patients that were there, the number of people and visitors, obviously, because they had restrictions, and certainly the number of patients that I had on my list. You know, as a palliative care doctor, I would probably typically have anywhere from say 10 to 20 patients at any given time in an average year or an average week, because it's kind of speculative if I just say a whole year, but in an average week, because we do 1 week at a time, you know, to go from that to two or three patients for the first 6 or 8 months of the pandemic for a palliative care physician is a bit strange. So there was definitely very big differences of that one side, but there's also big differences in what we're seeing happening in patients and presentations. There was a lot of cancers diagnosed end stage in very young people, and they had weeks left to live. And we haven't seen things like that that we started seeing ever that I'm aware of, none in my experience. And it should be raising questions in our minds as to what are the processes that are contributing to this. You know, the lockdown where there's, you know, no one can go and get testing or see their doctor for preventative care or have colonoscopies or elective, you know, non-essential things done. Well, who determines what is essential, I think, is the ultimate question, because somebody who gets diagnosed with a late stage colon cancer in their 40s would argue that that was essential earlier when it wasn't determined that by the government, right?
Right.
So we're seeing a lot of atrocities, as far as I'm concerned, that are caused directly from these measures that have been put in place. And I think they really do need to have a open discourse and debate and discussion amongst, you know, if they want the scientific table, well, there's a whole other group of experts and physicians and healthcare workers that have a totally different set of knowledge that contradicts what they're saying is right. And to get to the bottom of it and find the truth and find the actual way that we should be approaching infection control and pandemic response. Because if we're doing that in a way that it's harming enormous numbers of innocent younger people, and suicides are up and overdoses are, you know, have surpassed COVID deaths in Simcoe Muskoka for any same time period, these things are really harmful, and they have lasting effects into our future for our society and our culture and our civilization.
One of the things that, as you were speaking there, I immediately think about the fact that I don't want a doctor treating me from across the province. This is partly the reason why centralized decision-making about health is a ridiculous idea.
It's super harmful and dangerous.
Yeah. If I have a local doctor who wants to look at me and I ask for their advice and they want to give me advice about certain things, then that is I'm examined, I'm informed, I've been cared for, I'm a person in their eyes. Mm-hmm. To make all of these measures and then silence all of you doctors inside the system, it seems to me to be just symptomatic of a philosophy of centralized medicine rather than focused on the individual who's receiving the care. Why don't we talk a little bit about that? I want to ask you two questions. So first of all, a few weeks ago, there was a Facebook post from an individual within RVH specifically, where she made a number of claims about the hospital. To your knowledge, were those claims accurate? And I'm asking you that more so maybe in the framework of, do you know what has happened? Is that a real individual, or was that a total spoof where, you know, it was a total fake thing got passed around the internet, was completely erroneous? And what has happened with that situation? So can you share about that? Because that was a recent post that went quite viral across Canada. So, do you know anything about that? And was there any accuracy there? And what has happened?
I do. And she is a real person, and is a lovely, brave person. Very caring, and went above and beyond, you know, as a cleaning person. There was no direct responsibility or role with patient care. And I personally know this individual and have heard stories from her that she was having conversations with lonely patients, patients that were crying because their family members couldn't be there. That is a really caring, wonderful human being and only wants the best for someone else. So she is a real person and she is an honest, brave person. She told her story, her lived experience to the best of her ability without trying to be, you know, malicious to anyone in any way, but wants the truth to be known. And that's her lived experience. And there's nobody that gets the right to dismiss that or debunk it. That's what she lived through. And I have had similar experiences during my weeks in the hospital. It's not overrun. It's not overflowing. We've taken patients from Toronto a few times. I don't know if that was necessary. I don't know. And did that overwhelm our system? No. Were other patients turned away or maybe not admitted when they should have been admitted because we have to keep a certain number of beds available? Is that the best care for that patient at that moment? You know, these are things that are really important questions to ask ourselves. And have we participated in any of these actions that maybe weren't the utmost standard of care? You know, I think everyone gets lost in the idea that COVID or coronavirus is the only thing that is of concern. And that is a bold-faced lie. There are always many other potential harms or causes of harms to the physical body, but emotional and psychological damages from not being able to go in with your sick mother who's got delirium on top of a dementia, who can't answer questions to any doctor appropriately, and they won't let you come in. That is not safe. That's not safe. Nobody knows what you're doing to that patient. Nobody knows any answers. Nobody can ask any questions. It's just the doctor treating the incoherent patient who can't provide you any informed consent, but we're just going forward. There's ethics and morals that need to come first before we're putting any hands on a patient or doing any tests or ordering any treatment options for any patient. And, you know, the things that I've witnessed and experienced myself have been substandard as far as I'm concerned. And that is dangerous.
So the situation that you just described, it seems to go against any previous experience that I've had in hospitals where medical advocacy, how many times as a parent I've had to answer questions on behalf of my child. I've told my wife outright, like if she has to go to the hospital, we're going in there together and, you know, windows are getting smashed if I have to get in there with her. Like I couldn't imagine what people are going through in that situation. So tying together this, the story of the woman who shared openly, I want to ask a follow-up question to that. And that is, I don't know what has happened to her, But I do know that the Ontario College of Surgeons and Physicians have warned doctors against speaking out against anything. They've had it on their physical website. It's not easy to dig up. So we're going to get to that question about how she's been treated post this. Mm-hmm. But before I ask that question, are you feeling like it is a free environment to analyze and care for individuals? Or have you experienced coercion? Have you experienced a silencing? How has it been for you specifically?
It's been very different and very interesting. I'm a very strong person in my faith and my understanding of who I am and what I am. So I'm not shaken very easily. But in the middle of a pandemic that is, as deadly as is being reported on the mainstream media, you think that doctors would be collectively brainstorming and talking about what we can do in our hospitals or what we can do differently. But nobody is. It's radio silence, and it's very challenging. I think there's a lot of palpable tension because of the divide that's been created on a top-down model. It's not unvaccinated versus vaccinated, or those that are anti-lockdown versus lockdown. We don't get to label others. And these things are happening, but it's coming from a top-down direction. The leadership is doing these things, so therefore the staff feel that it's fine because they agree with that narrative. Well, there's a whole other narrative that people don't understand or know about and don't care about, but still think that they're morally superior because they're speaking the narrative of the tyrant leader. So, I'd argue that it's very different. It's very toxic. The morale is at its lowest. I've never seen staff members so. The word I can use is they look broken, and it's not because of all COVID patients. It's not because of the devastation of COVID. Yes, the respiratory floor where lots of COVID patients have been, there is likely many stories, but there's equal number of stories from or more from these other measures or the isolation. We know isolation kills elderly people. We know it deteriorates their overall health and mental status and psychological, emotional well-being. And yet we're still kind of at the point where we're encouraging things like that. The hospital has been a very different experience. I, as a palliative care doctor, have been coerced or attempting to be coerced to change a death certificate in a particular patient who was 88 years old, was dying of a cancer and actively dying within hours, was going to be gone from the earth. No family members were allowed to be in. And for some reason, this patient was tested for COVID-19 without her permission, obviously, and no one else was called because I spoke to the family after. And so without any permission, her body was invaded as she was actively dying and leaving this world. And she then tested positive, but was already gone, and I'd already filled out her death certificate. So 5 hours later, I'm getting a phone call from a nurse demanding that I change the death certificate. And I told her that no, this patient died of other causes, and I did not need to do that. I received another phone call from a different nurse or the manager or charge nurse or whomever, But two nurses now called me trying to persuade me to change the death certificate. And I did not need to. And then I get a phone call from one of the HSL people at the hospital saying that I needed to come and change the death certificate. So I told my story three times quite clearly. And as the most responsible physician, that's my determination to make clinically. And, you know, based on all of the evidence that I had at my disposal, it was not at all a part of her cause of death, not at all. And then my resident, who is a resident, is a medical doctor, but requires supervision. They're not able to practice independently. So my resident was then called and asked if this person would like to go and change the death certificate. So that's four attempts and in totally inappropriate, aggressive manner. And it was not at all involved. She was tested 2 days prior and tested negative. So it was not involved. And it was so forceful. And it was horrendous. It's horrendous.
So did the death certificate end up being changed, or did it stand that she did not die as a COVID death?
So these are not things that I'm fully aware of, because in Ontario, any physician can fill out a death certificate, and the most recent one trumps the previous one. So you can fill out 10 of them, and the most recent is the one that stands. So not to my knowledge, because I did not change it, but I do not know if somebody else would have done that. I don't think so.
We are talking about pressure to change an 88-year-old. Mm-hmm. So I'm a pastor. I've seen people dying in their last hours. I've seen someone not eat for 3 or 4 days and go, is the word gaunt, you know, like lose that body tissue. Yes. We're talking about that type of scenario. Yes. And you're being pressured four times in order to somehow tell the story that was not the death that it was.
Yes. And I even went to the manager of the floor the next day, because I thought that was, very unprofessional and uncalled for. And we would never do this in any other setting or scenario. So her response to me was essentially, oh, I know, sorry, it was, the nurses are getting so much pressure. Well, first of all, where are they getting pressure from? Who are they getting pressure from? And whose job is it to manage that they shouldn't be pressured? Nobody in healthcare should be pressured to do something that is wrong, that is not necessary, that does not provide any assistance or improvement to anything that we're doing, and certainly not to lie. I'm an honest, moral, ethical physician, and nobody has the right to try to make me sway that or change that. So, you know, that response was, again, also, it lacks any substance. It lacks any explanation. There's no good reason. And they're not even sure why they're doing it. So it's really hard to function in a facility where, you know, this kind of behavior is happening probably on a pretty consistent basis.
Crystal, has there been any other situations where you have been interfered with as you've cared for a patient?
There's been a number of concerning moments, for sure. I think the worst or most concerning patient was a lady who was in her 50s who unfortunately had a very aggressive uterine cancer. And this had spread to her bones, And basically, her entire spine had pathological fractures in it. And so she was now, unfortunately, in our hospital, really quickly approaching the end of her life. She had a big family. She had one of her sons had just gotten married, one of her daughters had just gotten engaged. You know, there's so many people that love this woman, and she's impacted. And I'm sure as a pastor, you must understand that in those last days and weeks, there's a lot of transfer of energy, of forgiveness, of positivity. And that is really important. And to not be allowed to have that arbitrarily, because again, from a top-down model, they say nope, that's too risky. She was denied the right to see her family. She was allowed to have her husband come in for 1 hour a day. And if it was truly about the risk of containing a virus, you know, arguably I can go into that hospital in my street clothes, and I can go into every patient room in the beginning with only one mask because PPE was so scarce, including a COVID room, and then the next room was a non-COVID room, and still have that same mask because we couldn't use more than one. And that's okay for viral control, but someone coming in to see their loved one while they're dying to say goodbye and to comfort them and to have the comfort of that person's love provided to the loved ones, that's somehow more dangerous. We couldn't possibly find a way to do that. And no, the process is at the hospital that you have to ask permission from, I'm not even sure which team it does, but the people that I've dealt with, I would have to say, they're not the most compassionate or caring people. They're robotic, and they don't see past the mandates and the measures to understand that life is not about mandates and measures, or even safety for that matter. It's about living, and it's also about experiencing love and healing and forgiveness. And the transfer of that energy when that person passes to you and to this world where she's left, you know, those things are very important that nobody really would like to talk about. So this person was denied the care that she truly needed at our hospital. And so as much as I didn't want to transfer her out of our hospital to another facility where she could have those needs met, I did. Because for her, she would rather be in a pain crisis and die in agony than not be able to say goodbye to her sisters and to her son-in-law, who's like her own son, and to her own children, and have her husband there while she's actively dying. We were not asking for, you know, 35 people to be in the room with her. I think it was a matter of five or six at the most. And that was not, they weren't able to come to any agreement that that could be done safely, but it could be somewhere else. So we transferred her. And I transferred her very reluctantly because I shouldn't have had to. I should not have had to transfer a patient with multiple fractures in her back from cancerous lesions that is so painful that we have no idea. She's not a patient that should be transferred. She should be allowed the comfort and the dignity that she deserves. And she was not awarded that. It was gut-wrenching, heartbreaking, and I'll never forget it.
I'm so sorry to hear that. So many danger signs in what you just described. You just described emotionless. Right. You just described robotic. That's the way that I have felt about this whole thing. As a pastor, you know, people say, you know, there's never so many lies told than lies that are told at a funeral. And it's partly because people forgive and people deal with the problems that they've been facing with each other for years. When you have somebody that you are saying goodbye to forever in the sense of this world, and then potentially for eternity. So you are, I really appreciate that story. I have to admit, even as you told it, the propaganda is so out there. Even as you told it, my one thought was, of course, safety shouldn't even be a factor. Just let the people in. The other side of it was like, were these people all symptomatic of an illness? Like, were they visibly like what I'm getting at is not only did they say, no, it's not safe, but they didn't, did they even look at the people who they were saying weren't safe, which means that a healthy man walking around with no symptoms is still regarded by a medical team as somehow unsafe to the environment.
No, they didn't look at any of the people. They didn't offer them any other possibilities of ways that they could do this in a safe way. The answer was just no. And it actually got almost kind of intentionally malicious, because I kept requesting them to reassess that. And I was advocating very strongly for my patient's wishes and her family's wishes and needs. And it was met with resistance, but then that resistance grew into frustration. And I wonder and fear if at times some of the decisions on whether patients can have families in come from a place of, this is the policy, or no, because I said so, because you're bothering me. So it's very concerning what I experienced in my lived clinical experience with this patient and this family. And I know that they appreciated everything that I did and everything that I tried, and they fully would back up everything I'm saying, because I know there'll be attempts to discredit even my experience. And this patient's unfortunate experience. You know, there's so many questions and so many inconsistencies that require pause, and there's been none. It's just forge on forward with the same orders, same mandates that are destructive and harmful. And if you're not seeing the destruction and harm, you're not looking very hard then. And you're living in a really privileged position to not see any of that, or hear about any of that, or be affected by any of that. Mm-hmm. And it's not okay anymore to continue dismissing lives that have been lost due to the measures that have been put in place by government. They have not been ever measures that have been agreed upon in any previous pandemic planning that we've had. And in fact, they're opposite. And why would we be doing that is beyond me.
So are you saying that there are pandemic plans that you would have been aware of for the hospital that have been ignored? Or did I misunderstand you? Or I want to be...
Sorry, not from the hospital specifically, but the pandemic planning from... a government perspective, you know, the requirements or the recommendations from the WHO, for instance. There was, you know, that's come from a top-down, trickle-down model that really, there's been no change in any direction. When we have a problem and 2 years later, we're far worse than we've ever been. At what point do we say, seems like this might not be working, and try something else? There's always multiple potential ways to deal with any issue or crisis. It's just a matter of, you know, is somebody willing to try something different? But it doesn't seem that we're allowed to try anything different. And there's a certain population that likes to believe that harsher tactics towards innocent, asymptomatic, law-abiding citizens is the answer. And I have to tell you, it's not the answer. It never has been and never will be. Not for humanity. It's destructive, it's harmful, and it will never result in anyone moving forward, and certainly not together. So this family that I was dealing with was lovely, and they were never sick, and they did not deserve to be treated as if they were sick and infectious. And that's part of the problem that we're seeing today, is that everyone is now treated as a sick person and a vector and harmful or dangerous. How are we ever going to live together in the world again, peacefully, united, you know, if we're only looking at each other as a threat? Well, we've never done this before. We've never tested people that didn't have symptoms. And in fact, in all my training, that's the biggest things that I remember, is if somebody doesn't have symptoms, we don't do those tests. So we already know that the asymptomatic spread is very little, if anything, that's contributing to the overall picture. And there's evidence to back all of this up, but for some reason, it continues on. And it has a lot of psychological and emotional damage to the human condition collectively. When you treat people as if they're sick, there becomes a learned helplessness. There becomes a need then to depend on others all the time. It's destructive and not empowering at all.
You've also identified the fact that there's an emotional weight to living a lie.
Absolutely.
When you're talking about the morale at the hospital, the morale is low because you have all of these people making money, not being able to do what they used to be able to do. And that was, if a family walked in and wanted to support their loved one, you could let them, because you can see that they're healthy.
Yeah.
And if there was somebody who was coughing up blood, you might not let them into a certain area and deal with what they're dealing with. But you wouldn't look at them like a bunch of rats. You wouldn't look at them like,
no,
like, you know, rats running around with the bubonic plague, because you weren't
right
contributing to a lie. And when I've been burdened for our health professionals. I've been burdened for our health professionals that many of them are carrying the weight of constantly living out a public lie. Are my words
too? And there are lots of lies, right?
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, there are a lot of misinformation and lies. But the people that are being pointed a finger at or blamed or shamed or, you know, said to be the spreaders of this misinformation are in fact not. They're probably some of the most versed and researched and intelligent and caring people that really, really want to not be living in a lie. And once you approach a situation or an issue with at least a different lens, and I'd argue multiple different lenses, you know, then you can finally start to see the full picture. But at no point is any one of us ever going to have a full understanding of what just happened in the world from 2020 to 20, God knows when. The best we can do is try together to piece what is consistent, what has facts and what can be proven, and what can be felt as right or wrong. I mean, everyone has to know when you're participating in telling a family that they cannot come in and see their dying loved one, you better have a really, really, really good reason for doing that. Otherwise, what you're doing is wrong. And if you can't look at this situation objectively and actually evaluate the risk, the true risk, it's already been identified multiple times by many, many great scientists, but also the CDC themselves. The risk of getting and dying from coronavirus 19 is quite low, and that risk is absolutely not the same for each and every person. And it substantially, that risk decreases as we get below 70 years old. So, you know, by and large, it looks very much like a bad flu season. Yes, there may be differences in terms of this virus and how it presents and sort of the sequence of events that happens during an infection. And it does really much affect the micro and macro vessels. And so it may start off as a respiratory, becomes an inflammatory, and then it moves on into a prothrombotic kind of state based because of the spike protein. And so we have lots and lots of information and data. And yet, again, it's not consistent with what is being done today. None of that risk ever mandates, would require a mandated vaccine. It wouldn't, not for everyone, for all things, or risk termination or worse. You know, what's next? Exclusion of the unvaccinated people from society. You can't buy your groceries anymore, or your phones are going to be turned off. You can't have access to things. How much sense does that make when we're looking at controlling the risk of a virus? It doesn't, because we know quite clearly that this vaccine has never stopped the spread. And we know that there are harms from it that were never told to us in the beginning. The biggest concern that I see is that the foundations of medical ethics are being trampled on. No longer are we actually providing informed consent. No longer are we respecting patients' autonomy in their medical decisions based on that informed decision process. You know, a forced and rushed medical procedure is never going to end up in any type of positive outcome.
So you have shared some information with me.
Hello.
I hit the record button, and we were talking about this woman who had already bravely shared her experience, and people are interested in truth. It is possible for people to bear false witness. It is possible for people to bear truthful witnesses. Are you concerned about the ramifications of you telling me stories that have happened to you now that we're talking? Like, again, typically, I can remember when my son received double the amount of a certain chemotherapy drug. It was just an anti-nausea drug. He received double the amount, and we had asked for it not to be in his protocol at all. So it was an error. If, you know, a doctor had have reported that this error was made, that this situation, you know, we had to deal with it this way, And they maybe shared that experience, you know, publicly, but without using our names and whatever, but hey, you know, this is some part of the comp being, you know, part of being on a team is this type of stuff happens. And never in my life would I have imagined that a doctor would have, or even a staffer would receive discipline or receive threats or have their good name tarnished. Are you concerned about talking this openly? And have you seen this happen with this woman who previously shared?
I'm absolutely concerned by and large why this is happening. It's not a question of, is it happening? You know, just yesterday, Dr. Julie Panessi, she is the most amazing bioethics person. And she is the right person to know the answers to the question of, can we mandate anything like this? And the answer is emphatically no. From a moral, ethical, and a bioethics perspective,
constitutional, legal.
Exactly. Yeah. Legal. You know, these are laws. These are laws that exist because atrocities have happened in the past. Why do we need to try to let them happen again before we realize, oh, no, that was a bad idea? So, of course, I'm worried about, you know, what kind of reaction I will get. But again, I'm strong in what I know is truth. I know that this is an absolutely historical time period that we could never have imagined living through. And I know that there's a right side of history and a wrong side of history. And I don't want to be on the wrong side of history, and I'm not going to be on the wrong side of history. So if there's going to be some kind of backlash or, I don't know, punitive damage done because I'm being honest and open, I think that's just a reflection of the corruption and the conspiracy that is in fact happening, and not a reflection of my character. Anyone that knows me knows the kind of doctor I am, the kind of person I am, my character, my integrity, and my reputation has always been very good. So we'll see what happens. I'm not really worried about kind of what attacks will happen. The bigger overarching concern is, why is this happening at all? People like Dr. Panessi and, you know, any Dr. Charles Hoff, there's Dr. Christian in Manitoba, the general surgeon. These are phenomenal human beings and doctors and bioethicists, and super important to the generations that are behind us that are going to be learning and picking up these traits. And if we're not allowed to be teaching them, there's going to be a lot of loss there, unfortunately. So that's one big concern.
So just to bring my listeners back up to speed, Dr. Julie Panessi has been speaking out. In fact, I would like to take credit that I think I was the first person to interview Julie, but I'll give her all the credit just because she contacted me. She's been speaking out. And I believe yesterday there was a big announcement about what happened to her. And I have to admit that I have heard everything about the situation, but the exact detail. Was she terminated from Western, or was she given an ultimatum that she must be vaccinated by a certain date?
So from my understanding is she was placed on a paid leave of absence. I don't know if this is totally truthful. You might want to look it up before you edit.
I'll call her.
Call her and ask her, because
yeah, I'll call her.
I'm curious. I've heard that she was in fact terminated, but then I read an article that said she was was a big newspaper like National Post or something, that that she was put on a paid leave of absence and until, I guess, such a date as she
can deal with her kangaroo court or her inquisition. Yeah, you know, yes. So everybody, I tweeted this out yesterday. If it wasn't such a tragic situation happening to Dr. Panessi, the irony would be utterly entertaining. Bioethics prof is terminated
of 20 years
for speaking against an unethical vaccination mandate. Let me just re-say that again.
Right.
Bioethics prof terminated or right. disciplined because she's standing against an unethical medical procedure. Like, think people, here,
here. So upside down.
Yeah.
It's totally, totally upside down. And that hypocrisy actually exists pretty much everywhere in this entire endeavor. You can look anywhere and you can find that same sort of irony or hypocrisy, if you will. And it's easy to spot now. I've really become very good at how to spot a liar is kind of my husband and I talk a lot about doing a series maybe of how do you spot a liar?
So many good sitcoms could come out of this if we don't spiral completely into an illegal world where we can't say anything, honestly.
Right. And I think that's really the concern of to what end, right? There's just been a continuous goalpost shift for the last 18 months. And now it's really dramatically sped up in terms of how quickly these goalposts are being shifted. But it's when you're silencing people that are bringing up valid concerns and questions in something that the world has never been through before, don't you think you're going to lose something there? Don't you think we should probably listen or at least allow people to make those questions or have some dialogue and discourse? You know, I was kicked off of Twitter. I had like 200 followers. I don't really post much, but what I did post, again, it's this sort of irony or hypocrisy, was that the CEO of Twitter had an old tweet that popped up on my feed, and it said, "We will forever support the First Amendment right of free speech." And of course, 1984 is like 2020. And so I'm reading that as I was looking through my feed, and I kind of had to comment because quite clearly in 2020, there's massive censorship happening. Everyone knows about this. And so I just commented and said, wow, this didn't age well. And I was kicked off of Twitter. So I was censored for commenting on their censorship that they said they wouldn't censor. So trying to make sense of all of this, of course people are confused. It's nonsensical. It's gone so far that we don't know our way back now. So we have to clear through the forest.
No, absolutely. There's another question that's been pressing on my mind, and that is the current vaccine mandate for RVH staff that is coming up quite soon. Are you aware of anyone in the hospital who is willing to walk off the job in order to object to these vaccine mandates? I am trying to dig up information from as many hospitals as possible where someone will tell me, yes, if we're forced, then they're going to lose X amount of their workforce. I think that if we had many doctors and nurses willing to walk off the job, maybe someone might immediately change their tune on this. Are you aware of anybody who's willing to walk off the job because of the vaccine mandates that are coming down the pike?
Absolutely. I can't give you an exact number, but I do know that there's a number of nurses, a number of other allied health staff in right. the hospital that are very much understanding that they are in control of their bodies, and they are not going to give away their rights to their choice of what goes in their body or what doesn't. I've heard people try to argue, well, then that's just the consequence of you not getting the vaccine. You lose your job. Under what other anything in the world is your job just so easily and quickly removed from you when you have previous contracts and there's legal and human rights and employee rights? I mean, it's not as simple as that. And I would hope that the employers understand that, because the backlash could be very significant.
Oh, and I'm hoping that it is. Like, you know, for every lawyer out there looking to get rich, would you please start getting involved in employment law and representing these individuals who are losing their jobs over these again, we talk about these details, and we still have to remember this is also over something that has been compared to a more severe flu season.
And, and statistically, and evidentiary, it's supported to be that. Again, yes, there's probably some differences, and I'm not going to dismiss anyone's loss or experience during this, and it might have been way worse for them. However, we have a lot of data. We know the riskier populations. We certainly know ways that we could protect them better than what we're currently doing. But we're not allowed to do that still. You know, there's things that are silenced and censored, and I'm getting faxes to my office saying drugs that are, you know, 50 years old are dangerous. And I've never had faxes like that before. So why all of a sudden? Again, there's a very aggressive, top-down, one single narrative picture that's happening, and I can't participate in it. I have to tell the truth that there's variation in life. There's different risk in life. We have risk every moment of every day, and we determine that for ourselves because it's our life.
Yeah.
The risk of somebody spreading COVID if they don't have symptoms is so super duper low. Less than, it's probably 0.1%, I think, is the statistic in the evidence. And it's not okay to continue on this way. It's very challenging to understand how people can continue to push forward, you know, encouraging more draconian, harmful measures on innocent people under the guise of public health safety. It's not offering any safety to anyone. It's causing harm. And I struggle so much trying to participate in it.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me openly. The one thing that I have learned from a few of my political friends is that it's better to do the right thing and to do it publicly. I've learned from my legal friends that justice needs to be done, and it needs to be done publicly.
Yes.
So to anyone who is listening to this podcast, if you are a medical professional, you should be telling your story publicly. And I would commend you, Crystal. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I know that you're putting a lot on the line, and we don't take that lightly. We know of chiropractors who are having their colleges want to take away their licenses. We know that people are receiving an incredible amount of personal attack, like Dr. Byram Bridle, like Dr. Julie Panessi. But I will say this, if there were 1,000 doctors in Canada who just went online on Facebook, spoke to people like me and said, this is what's actually going on and I'm not okay with it. This would be over tomorrow.
I would hope.
Right. And I believe the same thing of the church. If yes. ethical people would stand up and say, no, we are going to care for the sick. We are going to not treat people like villains. We're going to be a place of refuge. We are open. We're staying open. This would be over tomorrow. The solution is us, people. It is not waiting for legal precedent. You use your own eyes. You use your own ears. And as Dr. Crystal has pointed out, it's easy to spot a liar.
It really is these days.
It is. It's very simple.
It is.
If someone is telling you that you being perfectly healthy is you being sick, they're a liar. If someone
a liar.
Right. There's so many lies going on out there. If someone is saying, oh, you can't be with your dying loved one and that's to keep you all safe. Well, I'm no medical expert, but take them out of the hospital and care for them and do something so that they don't die alone. And that person who is telling you that they're doing the right thing, they're a liar because you know it. They're doing the wrong thing. So exactly. We need more people to stand up and say enough is enough and we're done.
And there's enough lived experiences of all of these wrongs that are happening on a daily basis. Human beings treating other human beings as if they are subhuman or not human is wrong. So many people being denied their rights that are legally entitled to is wrong. The list goes on and on of all the wrongs that we've experienced that people have been turning a blind eye to. The day has come and gone where that's acceptable anymore. Look around you. You see the devastation. I'd be totally interested to know what's our psychiatry unit at the hospital been? I don't think it's ever been like the rest of the hospital. It's been full and overflowing because people are struggling. And there's nothing that anyone is doing trying to help any people that are struggling through all of this. There's no relief. There's no end. Everyone just let's cross our fingers and hope they let us out of this soon. That's not how this is ever going to end. I feel like there's a lot of people that have maybe immigrated from communist countries. I have some patients of my own that have given me very clear kind of directive that, no, this is actually even worse than communism. And they are terrified. And they were terrified long before I was, which it kind of made me wonder, how scared should I be of kind of the damages and this destruction that's happening in our communities and in our world. And, when you have leaders encouraging neighbors to snitch on one another, we've seen this before in history many times. And it's never ended very well for anyone, let alone the snitchers. And why do we have to keep going down, to the pit of absolute human destruction before we say, whoa, this is quite similar to things we've seen and done in the past as human beings towards each other. Again, we could just pause. We don't even have to stop or put a moratorium on anything. We could just pause and we could reflect and we could have a group that connects of all different people, pastors and economists and sociologists and doctors and, because every different facet of life has been affected and influenced during this time, and not because of a virus. We have to remember that all a virus can actually do is cause a human body or maybe certain animal bodies, physical harm or death. But it can't cause all of this other stuff. It can't cause the segregation that's going to come.
Yeah, that's right.
With a vaccine passport. That's not from a virus. And that is not a natural consequence of not getting a medical injection. The natural consequence of not getting a medical injection would actually be physical death or harm, right? You know, we put far too much blind faith in the wrong people, and we remove our faith from the people we should actually be consulting and discussing things more with. Your friends and neighbors and family members that are questioning things or speaking differently or thinking differently than you might be, sit down and ask them questions. Why? You know, you seem really passionate. What's going on there? What do you know that I don't? I'm interested. But we also have to remember, put aside your ego, your thinking mind. There's more to the human condition and human experience than just being right. Or, you know, oh, why would they do that? Or, you know, these questions. And I don't know the answers, but I don't need to know those answers to know that they're wrong. And standing up for what is right and what is just and what is moral and what is humane is the way forward, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, and it's interesting, something that you said there got me thinking, particularly about, you know, conversation and dialogue and it's something that comes up a lot, and it's this like, can I know anything? You know, ask good questions. Mm-hmm. Of course, I believe in absolute truth. I believe that when we talk about things like the right side of history, the wrong side of history, that we are talking about someone saying, yes, you understood the situation correctly. And again, never before have I experienced such a world where pride, salaries, and political pressure have made so many people over here not have healthy dialogue.
Absolutely. And it's like, dangerous.
It's very dangerous. So there's very little healthy dialogue going on in the midst of the churches. There's very little healthy dialogue going on among the medical community. There's very little dialogue going on because there are consequences to dialogue. There's consequences to you speaking out.
Yes.
You know, my listeners have heard me say this a bunch of times. I face up to 3 years in jail and up to $300,000 in fines simply because I lived out my religious convictions and yes. kept my church open for a week or two during COVID pandemic.
Right.
While my whole church yeah. could get in a car, that we would have all driven our cars. We could have all walked into Walmart on the same yes. Sunday together, yes. sang hymns in Walmart, and everything would have been fine. But to go into my church respectfully, carefully, because we believe that the Lord needs to be worshiped. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is I'm trying to just highlight what you were saying, that yes. It's these normal behaviors that are so healthy for us.
Yes.
And it's not because there's this great truth that has been revealed. It is simply because of, I want to keep my job. I'm being told that I will be penalized if I speak up. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole ton of public pressure now because people don't know which side to be on. And so I just want to, again, I appreciate your perspective there. And I'm trying to summarize it in, let's be people who can discover truth, because we know that there's scientific truth. We know that there's a good medical way of dealing with certain things. In fact, we had already previously discovered many of those ways.
Yeah. Yes.
Let's return to our previous laws and practices and get through all of this pressure, this externalized pressure.
I think really the truth, as you know, it sets you free, and it would set the entire world free if you understand the mechanisms that are at play here. There's not, you know, there's a way to understand it that can be universal, because they're truths, there's facts, they're things that you can piece them all together and fully understand exactly what has gone on. And you can't focus on the questions like why, or, you know, who exactly is making that mandate. Again, those are kind of semantics. They don't really affect it. It's here's the problem. What are we going to do about it? There needs to be more solution-based, action-based approaches to what's happening, or else we're going to continually find ourselves, you know, in a fourth lockdown, potentially, with greater than 85% of Ontarians double vaccinated, and, oh, you need your booster next. And there's too many inconsistencies that we don't know the repercussions of all of those things that are being amalgamated together as science. What is the foundation of science? It's asking questions. And it's taking time for pause and observation. It's not forging forward and making people, you know, lose their jobs and livelihoods and houses and you know, reputations, because that's just not what a virus would do. It's what people do to one another. It's
interesting. I thought you were going to say, that's not what a doctor or a scientist would do. The scientist would pause and observe.
Absolutely. And so would a doctor.
Right. And so It's interesting, because when you said that, I was thinking she's going to say that's not what a doctor would do. And I was going to jump in and say, but that's what a politician would do. Okay. I do want to bring our discussion to a close. You made a comment earlier that we could see how to come out of this universally.
Mm-hmm.
And it triggered me, though, to think about, though, the how. And the how is usually locally. So mm-hmm. I can't usually figure out, in fact, in my Christian worldview, I can't figure out all of the evil schemes that are going on around the world. But like we've said earlier, locally, I can identify a lie. But then the universal principle that then can lift you out of that is locally living out a universal principle, which is I won't tell a lie.
Right.
So,
and I think that's where it starts.
Right. We start locally and we go, okay, this is the right thing to do locally. We apply a universal principle, and then it trickles up to affecting the globe. And that's where everything is the opposite world right now, where people say, no, one person who's very far away tells everybody a lie, and they do it and they live it. And that's going to get us out of here. And we've got to stop that. We've got to reverse it. And so I appreciated how you were both saying at the same time, there's a universal benefit that we could have. There's a global benefit that we could have,
mm-hmm.
but that has to start with a local analysis of the situation and then the truthful rendering of the situation.
It does. And it has to be honest and authentic, and you have to be able to admit you're a flawed human being and that you have lied or sinned before, and that you don't want to pursue that anymore. You want to be the best version of yourself, as honest and authentic as you can. And I made that decision a very long time ago, but it seems to be really beneficial right now, because I've already been practicing that in my life, and in all my relationships and with all of my patients, and it's really rewarding. And there's no pit of my stomach feeling of what a lie feels like. You know when you're participating in something that is bad, that is harmful. And you know, I look around and I see it everywhere, and I see people participating in for those shallow reasons, those reasons of, well, I need my job, I have to go to work. And I get it, it's significant to everyone, because how are they going to pay for their life and their house? And I get it. But listen, you're a skilled person, you can go do anything else that doesn't reduce your integrity or your morality so much that you're doing acts of, you know, crimes really against other human beings. You know, it's an attack to call somebody a name, it's an attack, or you know, it's just a maliciousness that exists in the world if you are blaming and shaming human beings for a microscopic germ spreading, as if it's so simply answered as, here, this little group of people that wants to, you know, not comply is the problem. Life is messy, life is complex, so is this problem, and you can't reduce it down to you know, a minutia of the overarching group of people that exist in the world. And you certainly should understand that if you're off, you're encouraging or agreeing with egregious acts and segregation, that is not the right action forward.
And we've seen this in history again. Everybody,
yes,
everybody, we've seen this so many times throughout history. And I want to just repeat as we close off, the solution is more people talking about their local honest stories. So if you're a staffer at RVH, So if you're a staffer at RVH, instead of throwing Crystal under the bus, get out there and get your own microphone and start telling about what's going on. And even if you're telling the opposite side of the story, at least it's an honest dialogue.
Right.
Don't call any names. Don't make any accusations. Just tell the truth about your story. And if you happen to be in the ICU and you happen to be really scared about this thing still, tell that story. At least it'll be honest, and we'll dialogue with you.
Right.
We still might want to fight the conclusion of mandates, but at least we'd all be talking openly. So, you know, I invite anybody, if you hear this podcast and you want to come on and you want to tell about your story, we're open to talk. And actually, Dr. Byron Bridal has said this. He's made that same invitation a number of times, and he doesn't get anyone who's willing to come on and oppose him publicly. Yep. So,
and I think really that's the government and public health's role. Why are they not calling a scientific debate? Why are they not calling for, you know, these groups of people to come together and hash it out? Because there's lots that would love to, and not in any aggressive way by any means, but in respectful, open, honest, scientific discussions. We used to do that all the time, but I think people forget that. And now we just lecture at each other and make sure that we've done it loud enough that it's just then believed. And that's not something I'm interested in participating in. Can I ask you one question? It doesn't have to be on here.
It can be on here if you want it. You go ahead and ask me a question. This is cool, folks. This is the first question I've ever been asked. So,
okay. And it's one that I think is very relevant. And I'm very curious, because I'm not an overtly tied to any church per se, but I'm very spiritual. And I can see Revelations is really playing out in this physical realm. Would you agree or disagree? And what are your comments on that?
Well, thank you for the question.
You're
and I would like to invite everybody to our church meeting on Sunday, which is located in on the 10 acres of my house, while we meet outdoors in Alliston. I'm not going to give my address publicly, but you and I can talk about it later. I am beginning to preach through the book of Revelation right now on Sunday mornings.
Incredible.
And I would say this, Revelation, people do not understand that the book of Revelation is a theology, mm-hmm. not a timeline. Mm-hmm. So it is a beautiful vision. Very often the prophets in the Old Testament who had visions and wrote, they were talking about what would transpire in the real world, mm-hmm. but they were seeing it. The Lord gave them a vision full of visual symbols mm-hmm. that would evoke a response emotionally and pictorially that would affect the way they live. Right. So for example, when Tolkien or C.S. Lewis wrote, you know, the stories that they wrote, sometimes we learn the truth of those stories more because we've seen the picture than because we've learned the detailed history. Like my favorite book of the C.S. Lewis series was The Horse and His Boy. And there's this moment where Erebus, one of the key female leaders, female characters, Aslan digs his claws into the back of her and wounds her because she was being a brat. And later on in the story, you learn that that was the Lord's discipline on her. And you learn that Aslan, of course, she healed. And then she talked with Aslan about why it happened and why he would wound her. And no one needs to talk to me about the consequences of sin. Like, I understood that picture. So the book of Revelation is even, like, of course, because it's scripture, far more authoritative, but it is those types of pictures that are thrown out at us that we go, oh, once I understand the picture, then I understand what's going on around. So I would say this, the book of Revelation has been being fulfilled since the time of Christ until he will return again. And yes, we are in a cycle where all of the oppressive, aggressive behaviors against the church are really starting to be seen in North America. I think if you lived in, if you were a Christian in Iran, or you were a Christian in Afghanistan, or you were a Christian in China, these symbols would have been meaningful. If you were a Christian in Russia, these symbols would have been meaningful to you all the way through. Cause you'd go, oh, that's how I feel.
Right.
So yes, I am teaching my church through the book of Revelation because we need to theologically understand the symbols that God gave the Christians to go, oh, that is happening today. And here is how I should respond.
Right.
But I will not probably be teaching my church that, okay, this is that. So now we know that we're at the end of the end. I'll more be talking about the fact that we've seen this before. We might be in the very last time we'll see it. We could be at the end of the end. But we are certainly seeing, and again, we're seeing it in the Western world now more than the church in the East would have been able to see for years. Mm-hmm. So does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. I appreciate that. And I like your distinction there about sort of the theology versus, you know, in actuality. But you can see that as more and more information is coming out, it is evoking, and information is symbols. So people that, you know, don't believe in symbology, or, you know, the kind of call it foo-foo or something, everything that we do is symbols. Our language is symbols. So the symbology is coming out at a rapid pace. And it's, you know, for people that have some, I'm not going to pretend to have a lot of knowledge, but some knowledge of that theology, you can just make those connections so quickly, and understand that this is a battle of good versus evil. Way bigger than all of us could ever imagine, and it's and that's why I think I'm very strong in my convictions. I understand, you know, who I am. I'm not just a physical body. I understand the world a lot better than maybe 10 years ago. but it's really that battle that's happening.
I'll give you a perfect example. So there is a passage in Revelation, I believe it's Revelation 8, where as a part of the vision, the prophet is given a scroll and he's told to take it and eat it. And so in your mind, you're like, okay, scroll, crumple it up, eat it.
Yeah.
And he's promised that it will be sweet to the taste, but it will turn his stomach bitter. And two things he's told. He said it will be sweet and then it'll become bitter. And then it's told to him in the same way you are to prophesy to the nations. Mm-hmm. So prophesy means to tell the truth, to warn. So I don't know. You can even hear it in the way that you and I are dialoguing.
Yeah.
There is sweetness to the truth.
Yeah.
But we both know that we're going to feel sick to our stomach sometime because of the consequences of us telling the truth.
Right.
I'm going to be nervous when someone puts me on the spot. I'm going to feel sick when someone points a finger and says, how dare you? I'm going to lay awake at night when someone says, you're telling the truth and I might lose my job over it. There is a responsibility that comes when you tell the truth, and it's sweet when you say it, but it very often makes your stomach sick after you've right. said it out loud. So yeah. all that to say, you and your husband only live in Innisfil. You're invited to our house on Sunday and you should come and listen to me teach the book of Revelation. It would be greatly encouraging.
I would love to. Thank you for the invitation.
Okay. And with that, we're going to sign off and say goodbye to everybody else. So thank Bye. You so much for being on with me, everybody. We just did some analysis and we are one of the top 15 podcasts in Canada for politics. So please keep going to Spotify, to iTunes, to Podbean, download this podcast and give us a 5-star rating. Thank you so much, Crystal, for being with us. And we Thanks pray Godspeed in the next few weeks as you live in this world of being public.
Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity and the platform to be able to, you know, express my perspective and my lived experience through this pandemic.
You're most welcome.
Thanks for tuning in to this Liberty Coalition Canada interview, a united front to restore liberty and justice in Canada. Please subscribe to our podcast and Rumble channel, as well as visit our website at www.libertycoalitioncanada.com.